I believe that we've balanced all the interests of all the parties in this police reform debate. I, of course, had some amendments that went a little further, but I believe it's the perfect bill now for all of us to sign and work on together.
And State Representative Holmes, do you feel the same way?
I believe just part of the process is making sure that the core four cornerstones that the elected of color stood in front of the State House are in any bill that shows up. And I can tell you just throughout all of the negotiations, those things have not been at risk. I am pleased that they continue to be in the bill, even with the governor's amendments.
And would you list those four cornerstones for our listeners, please?
Sure. The four cornerstones, to me, the central, most important part of the bill is the possibility to decertify police officers, or what we've called POST, peace officer or police officer, however you may want to put that. Police officer standards and training, which is a requirement for a certain level of training in the Commonwealth, a certain amount of requirements for what they're going to have for certification to be a police officer, but most important, to be able to decertify a police officer when they go out of what we would expect for any police officer. The second is what Brett Miranda sponsored, was the use of force models about what to do about chokeholds, no-knock warrants, what to do about duty to intervene, and the like. And then we wanted to reform the way we look at civil service, which is how we hire our police, fire, and EMS. And then finally, a lot of commissions and work to be done around structural racism, as that is very important, because many people feel like structural racism does not exist, and it offends, and it continues to offend many white people. When I talk to them, I was just actually having a conversation with my manager and a partner. Again, it just feels as though it's a racist comment for when black and brown people say structural racism exists.
There's so much there, Representative Holmes, and I want to come back to Representative Miranda for just a minute. State Rep Holmes just laid out the four cornerstones. I noted that you also had an amendment in the bill to severely restrict the use of so-called no-knock warrants by police. It's the type of warrant that became the subject of so much attention after the police killing of Breonna Taylor in Louisville. You actually were a co-author of an op-ed in the Boston Globe last week, along with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, DA Rachel Rollins, and Boston NAACP President Tanisha Sullivan, arguing that that's really important to preserve. Are you concerned, therefore, that the governor may strip it out?
You know, as we laid out in the op-ed, you know, we know that public policy should be designed to protect and value the lives of all, not just some. And we argued in that op-ed that SWAT-like tactics of no-knock raids, they pose significant danger to innocent families, unarmed suspects, and actually officers, too. I was concerned earlier, but I'm not concerned now because it looks like the governor has actually sent out some amendments. But we know that we got to keep fighting. We don't need another tragedy. You mentioned the death of Breonna Taylor, but there are over 110 deaths a year happening due to no-knock warrants and over 1,000 in police-involved interactions. And they're happening disproportionately to communities like us, to black women and black men like us, and to our children and our elders. You know, when I wrote that amendment, I wanted a full-out ban on no-knock warrants, but my amendment was moving us closer to having like a heightened level of scrutiny and allowing only judges, not clerk magistrates, to make these decisions where there was a credible threat to officer safety without it. And the provision that really caused a lot of debate really required that officers confirm that no children and seniors are in the target location. And so as black women and black men, we know all too well the experiences of the communities we represent, and we know that we can have public safety and police accountability go hand in hand. And so we're pushing, and I'm going to do everything in my power to push my colleagues, to push the governor, and push the legislature to not support any changes to this bill, because folks worked really hard on this, and I do believe that it is a balanced approach.
Representative Holmes, you've been an advocate for reform on issues of criminal justice for years now. Earlier, when you gave us the four cornerstones, you talked about POST, the Peace Officer Standards and Training Commission. You know, over the summer, as the bill was being developed, I think we had a lot of attention on qualified immunity, and there was a lot of sense that that was going to be a big lightning rod, a big source of controversy. Coming out of committee, it seems that a big area of controversy, especially for law enforcement, is this nine-person body, this commission, and the fact sure. that only three of those members would be law enforcement officers. The Boston Police Patrolmen's Association tweeted yesterday calling that power imbalance tantamount to a quote-unquote firing squad. Did you anticipate when this bill came out of committee that this was going to be such a controversial piece for law enforcement?
I did not. I did know from the beginning that they wanted, they were offended that the board was not going to be literally 100% of people who are in law enforcement. But to me, it's offensive that that's their position, because what they've said to me the entire time is that we as police officers don't want bad police officers on the command staff or in our team or in our ranks. Well, it shouldn't matter who's on the board and how many people they have on the board. If they are true to what they have said, when something comes in front of them, just like it comes in front of every jury that we have in this country every single day, you don't have to be an expert at what they've been doing every single day. And so these folks, all of these officers, should understand, just like they arrest people and then they have to be held accountable in front of just all the ordinary citizens should as well as them, be involved in this conversation of whether or not we take their license or not. That seems
so I understand that. I do want to stop you there and ask you, though, we're talking about 3 of 9, and just to kind of walk all the way through this. So there is room for there to be potentially more law enforcement officers without there being a majority. And I do want to ask you to address head on the claim or the criticism that it takes someone with specialized knowledge to understand a job that requires specialized skills.
Okay.
How do you address that piece of it?
I say there are 12 members on every jury. You don't make them have to be an expert to make those decisions. They arrest people, and they expect people to go in front of 12. Now they want to have a supermajority or a majority when we're making a decision about them just because they're police officers. Why are they different than everybody else in society? It doesn't make sense to me.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And State Representative Miranda, following on to that, so we have spoken with a number of law enforcement representatives at various times during this reform process. And I want to ask you, do you believe that there was a police reform bill that could have come out of the State House that would have been meaningful to you and could have received endorsement from law enforcement unions? Was that a possibility?
I don't think so. You know, for me, this is not, you know, from the beginning, we've made it clear that we centered racial justice in our conversations about police accountability. As the person who, you know, Russell and I both, Rep Holmes and I both have largely of color districts. And I believe strongly that police can't police police. And what we've seen across this country and even the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is this narrative that they know best. And if they knew best, and they could hold themselves accountable, we wouldn't have this large number of 1,000-plus people and families across this country that have dealt with police-sanctioned homicide or the families that have dealt with these no-knock warrants. So I don't actually support any more officers on this committee. I believe that in the legislation, which I fully support the makeup, I would have loved to see more advocates and social justice representatives. But it was clear from the beginning, particularly when you're talking about use of force guidelines, when you're talking about banning chokeholds, banning the use of dogs and tear gas, it was a really hard-fought battle to change the mindsets and public opinion from folks to say that Black lives do matter. And that we don't only value police officers and those in law enforcement and government, but we value everyday citizens of our Commonwealth, and we want to make sure that Massachusetts is safer and healthier and more secure for them. You know, it's really been troubling to me that this narrative that it doesn't happen in Massachusetts is actually going around there, and most of the unions have used this to promote this propaganda. It is not true. Policing in communities like Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan differ quite from policing happening in other more affluent, more white communities.
So State Representative Holmes, just there, State Representative Miranda, fed back some of the pushback law enforcement have given around the fact that this was a police reform bill that perhaps wasn't necessary here in the Commonwealth because it was in response to police brutality, police racism happening in other
miles
states.
Away, they said,
yep. Yes. And State Representative Miranda just gave us an answer to that. I want to ask you to weigh in, too, and I'm going to sharpen the question for you. And we have this moment. The governor's going to make a choice. There will be an outcome. What is at stake now for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts with this bill, in your mind?
As sharp as you just made it, I'm going to still make it even sharper for me because it's personal. To Rep. Miranda's point about it's happening today, I had a very unfortunate incident in my family where my sister, just 3 or 4 years ago, or maybe even 5, was standing at the Dudley Square train station and was pulled aside trying to help someone she thought was being inappropriately treated at the MBTA and was abused, batoned, beaten, arrested, simply for trying to stop the police from harassing what she felt a person she didn't even know. And I can tell you, my sister has never been the same. That confident lady that I knew before she was beaten that day is not the same person today. And so what is at stake is that folks like my sister should be able to sit at the Dudley Swift train station and be compelled and know and be able to know that any police officer, whether they be state police, Boston police, MBTA police, would be held accountable for any misdeed that they've done. And their license and their ability to continue to be a police officer will end the moment we find out that that is the case. And that should happen here in Massachusetts, not just in the other 47 states or whatever, 46 states that have a post system in place today.
Representative Holmes, I'm sorry that that happened, and I appreciate you sharing that story with us. Thank you for that. Representative Miranda, so last question to you. Amendments are coming in now. So that implies that the governor is not going to sign the bill as is tomorrow night. There is not a veto-proof margin on the original bill in the Massachusetts legislature. What is the next step now?
So I will do everything in my power to push my House colleagues, as I've done since June and before June, not to support these amendments, because I do believe that the risk of failing is actually too high and Black lives are on the line. When I think about what we as electeds of color stood out on the state house steps and pronounced with our 10-point plan, we were not doing that just because we're elected, right, of color. We did that because we have lived experiences like the one that Rep. Holmes shared, that we have family, community members, friends, even in some cases some of us have been inappropriately communicated with and harassed by police. We cannot afford to let this go. We have to fight. And so I think part of what I've been doing, and my colleagues have been right beside me, is that we have to reimagine policing to make all of our communities safer. And I do believe that this legislation is a first critical step in the legal system, and it's a part of this long-term vision. We understood when we presented this budget, when we presented this legislation and the accompanying budget amendments and other amendments, we knew that we were just starting with the beginning. Massachusetts is not immune to racial injustice. It is not immune to police inaccountability and misconduct. And so for me, I'm going to push back, and we're going to fight together. And I need everyone in the Commonwealth. You know, I've heard a lot of people say Black Lives Matter in the last few months. We now need to show up, show out, and prove that this actually matters to us. I think for the 20% of Black and Latino people who are in the Commonwealth are really depending on us making sure that our lives value as much as anyone else's. And
Representative
I apologize,
Liz
I'm a little
Miranda.
Emotional. I mean, I think that part of our work when we go to the state house as, I think, one of 13 out of 200 legislators, 13 people of color, and then 200 legislators in total, is that we bring our full selves to this work. And this is deeply personal and deeply emotional, that we are at a crossroads in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and I want the legislature and the governor to do the right thing, to do what is not easy, what is uncomfortable, but what is morally right.
That was State Representative Liz Miranda, who represents the 5th Suffolk District, and State Representative Russell Holmes, who represents the 6th Suffolk District. And again, we reached out to representatives from multiple law enforcement unions to join the conversation, but they either declined or didn't answer in time for the show. Tuesday marked the end of the semester at Stonehill College in Easton. Now, Stonehill brought students back to campus this fall. Every local college and university faced tough choices about how to handle educating students in a pandemic. Their choice for in-person learning didn't go uncriticized. So back in September, Peter Ubertasio, Dean of Arts and Sciences at Stonehill, joined us here on Radio Boston to explain and defend that decision. Well, with the semester behind us now, we invited Dean Ubertasio back to talk about how it went, and he's here now. Dean Ubertasio, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Peter, so with the semester behind you now, I'm going to ask you, do you still believe Stonehill made the right decision, and kind of what metrics are you basing that on?
Oh, I absolutely believe we made the right decision. It was really wonderful to have our students back. I would say that in addition to inviting students back, we also gave students the option to attend classes remotely during the fall semester, and we've continued that into the spring semester. So, you know, really we had a combination of in-person, online, remote access for our students, and we'll have it for the entire year. And part of the reason I'm so happy we did is that our transmission rate on campus was extremely low. You know, so we invited students back. We implemented all of the safety protocols that we needed to, physical distancing in residence halls, dining facilities, and classrooms. And we did not have a outbreak on campus, and did not have any, you know, transmission from, say, student to faculty member or staff member on campus. And our positivity rate was extremely low for the entire semester.
I'm glad to hear that. Has that been the attitude of faculty and students as well? Have people been largely satisfied that the on-campus learning experience was the right choice for the fall?
Well, yes, I think so. You know, we, again, because we were able to partner with the Broad Institute and implement weekly testing for all members of our community, faculty, staff, students, and some, you know, some members of the community were tested twice a week. We were really able to catch any incidents of COVID, isolate folks appropriately, and ensure that the semester could proceed safely. But I would say that, you know, there were costs, and one of the costs, mm-hmm. In addition to turning an entire facility into a COVID testing center, is having to teach and learn in an environment where you have a number of students accessing a class remotely while a number of other students are in person, and that presents real pedagogical challenges. So the benefits outweigh all of that, but it was an exhausting semester for everyone.
So the Easton Town Administrator, Connor Reed, has said that because Stonehill was doing a lot of testing, had a lot of negative results, and that reduced essentially the positivity percentage rate in Easton. And now the students are gone. They're going home for winter break. And he worries that that affects the denominator, basically, and the town could see a higher rate of positivity. That is backward of what we heard people predicting in the fall, right, that students were going to be the ones to drive up positivity rates. I wonder how much of that has to do with Stonehill's ability to test on a weekly basis, which is what you've been doing, I believe, all along this semester. Or is that just a larger indication that we were expecting students to spread the virus in Massachusetts in the way they have not?
I think it's a combination of both of those things. You know, we made the decision early in the summer that we were going to do onboarding testing before the semester began, and then weekly surveillance testing. And in addition to that, we put in very strict protocols about accessing campus. So that helped us to really reduce the spread of the virus on campus. And I would say also that, you know, weekly testing is crucial, but so is doing your part. And we're also proud of what our students, what our faculty and staff put themselves through. So we had rigorous mask wearing on campus. We physically distanced outdoors, indoors. We had to put a lot of effort into finding new ways to engage with one another, but we did it in a way that was safe. So I think that having a population of people who are willing to listen to public health authorities is also crucial in mitigating the spread of the virus. And we demonstrated that you can do that. Now, you know, we have some things working in our favor. You know, Easton is not the type of college town that, say, Ann Arbor is or other places. We don't have a big presence of, right, we don't have a big presence of fraternities or sororities off campus. And so, you know, the model that worked for us may not necessarily work quite as well in other places that have their own unique challenges. But I do think that there's something to be learned from the kind of safety protocols that we implemented and that were followed.
You held the last day of classes before Thanksgiving. And I'm assuming that that meant that if students went home, they stayed home, or the idea was that that would reduce post-Thanksgiving transmission, which, of course, in the Commonwealth, we're seeing now. What other changes did you make that you think were critical to this being successful? And do you think you'll carry any of them forward sort of post-vaccine?
Well, you know, we made some changes to our schedule that were hard to take and were difficult for our students. And they, you know, they registered their concerns with me and with others on campus. For example, we canceled breaks, long weekends. We worked through the holidays. We've already canceled spring break. The desire is to keep folks on campus, and campuses have proven to be very safe environments. So we want to keep them on campus. But, you know, it's an intense experience. Your average college student at Stonehill is taking 5 classes a semester, and it's a lot of work with little respite because we canceled the breaks in order to prevent the spread of the virus. So that presents a lot of mental health challenges and exhaustion, right? Because it's not just canceling a break, it's canceling the break in the midst of a pandemic that creates all of its own new sets of anxieties. So some of the things that we've had to do to mitigate the spread of the virus have created other challenges for us that we've tried to meet. But to your other question, like what can we imagine that we've learned from this that we might continue doing? Well, we have just a whole new array of really well thought out hybrid and online courses, new digital tools that have been used and implemented. And while Stonehill and so many other institutions will remain a residential institution, I think we're going to see greater use of digital tools moving forward in a way that really enhances student learning.
I have a freshman at a different university, Peter, and she is on campus. And there were some positives and some negatives, but even being there, a lot of loneliness, a lot of feeling isolated. We do have a vaccine coming. Young, healthy people are not really scheduled until phase 3, which is really the spring, probably April timeframe. But do you have hope that before the end of next semester, you'll begin to see the kind of vibrant social interaction that is also important to students on a campus?
You know, my oldest child is a first year college student, and so I experienced this both as a dean, as an educator, but also as a parent. And I fully appreciate the loneliness that this pandemic has caused, the mask wearing, the physical distancing, the lack of just kind of spontaneous gatherings. But I would say that our team worked overtime to provide the kind of student engagement that students expect, and we are all looking forward to our campuses being places of vibrancy once again.
Peter Ubertasio, Dean of Arts and Sciences at Stonehill, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Economists warn that the U.S. will slide further into recession without more stimulus relief from Congress. But even with further financial intervention, it's going to be a long road back to pre-pandemic economic health. Suzanne Althoff, a former Boston Globe magazine editor and assistant professor at Emerson College, says one way out of the recession and towards a more equitable future is to invest in women entrepreneurs. And there's data to back her up. Research from the Association for Corporate Growth in 2015 estimates that if U.S. women launched high-growth firms at the same rate as men, we'd add 15 million jobs in only 2 years. That's just one of the many conclusions drawn in Althoff's newest book, Launching While Female, Smashing the System That Holds Women Entrepreneurs Back. Althoff is here with me now to talk about that work. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tiziana. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. And let's dive right into the big thing. Why are women entrepreneurs such a big piece of the answer for our economy?
Yes. Well, I think if you stop to think about it, we need full entrepreneurial participation in order to have as many companies as we need, as many jobs as we need. If anyone is sitting on the sidelines who has a great idea, that's harmful for all of us.
You know, as I was reading the book, I thought several times, all right, we've heard lots of arguments out there that the market's smart, the market figures it out, it gets us to optimal, it'll get it done. But if we're leaving 15 million jobs on the table in only 2 years, that's a lot of lost economy profitability. Why isn't the market getting it done?
Yeah. I mean, I in the book I write about the meritocracy myth, right? Exactly what you're saying. We all have this assumption that, oh, the best ideas, the hardest, the people who work the hardest, they get ahead, they will get their companies launched. And it's the research again and again shows, and also reports from the field show that's not the case. There are significant funding disparities, for example, that means some entrepreneurs just simply don't have enough of the money they need to start a company or to grow a company. And part of this is the racial wealth gap in our country. That means that black entrepreneurs start a company with a significantly less money than a white entrepreneur. Or the gender pay gap also means women entrepreneurs start companies with less money in their bank account than a man.
You know, at one point in the book, you compare, this is a 1988 congressional hearing on women entrepreneurs, and then a congressional roundtable in 2008, hosted by then-Senator John Kerry. The problems in those two things, they were the same. There had been very little change in that time. That can be discouraging, but we are also arguably in a new moment. We are post-hashtag MeToo, or at least in the middle of that reckoning. Do you think there's an opportunity for change now that there hasn't been over the decades that women have been experiencing this disadvantage, structural disadvantage and funding disadvantage?
I do, Tiziana. I really do. And I say that for a couple of reasons. First of all, the pandemic has shown all of us that we can't leave any opportunity on the shelf. We need to get serious, and people who have great ideas for businesses need to be supported and funded. I would also say that we're beginning to open our eyes to structural racism and all the ways that has been playing a role in our lives, and it's certainly a part of our business lives. Back to the earliest days of our country, I did research into the ways white supremacy has affected who's opened a business and who has not. So there's a lot of conversations and interest, especially for women of color, who are showing such an expressed interest in entrepreneurship. There's a lot of interest in supporting them finally, after, as you say, after decades of talking about it, to actually get real. And I'll just cite one example. There's a nonprofit group called All Raise, which is working to bring more women investors into the venture capital community and also to support more women founders. And they just raised $11 million to really advance their work. So that's promising. So we really need to take advantage of this moment that we're in with the pandemic and discussions about systemic racism and push to make sure it happens. And I will also add the student debt relief conversation that seems to finally be getting serious. That would have a real impact on underrepresented entrepreneurs, because researchers at Northeastern found that people who have student debt are less likely to start a business, or the business, if they do start one, is slower to grow. So if we were to have some targeted student debt relief, that could really increase the number of companies in the country and the number of jobs.
And let's stay in the solution space, and I'll stay on student debt relief with you for a minute. I'm not quite sure how to ask this question, but does life stage matter? So one could provide student debt relief immediately, or one could provide it or mitigate it over time. From what we know about women who launch businesses, found businesses, does life stage matter? Do we need to be supporting women for startups immediately after college? Is it, after several years of work experience? Does it not matter?
That's a wonderful question. There is a lot of research that having a couple of years of work experience matters a lot and really aids your company formation. If you have experience managing a company, being a leader, managing employees, and managing a budget, that is all wonderful experience before you start a company. And that's actually part of the equation why women entrepreneurs can be at a disadvantage, because they often don't have these advancement opportunities in the workplace. And that, in my research also on the glass ceiling, when it came into use in the early 1980s, it was surprising to me to know that the glass ceiling, when people talked about women unable to advance, often what the women did was leave the companies they were working for and start their own business. So to your original question of, is there an ideal age to start a company? No, I think we need to support entrepreneurs at all along the spectrum. And also because so often entrepreneurs experience an unmet need first, personally, and that inspires a company, or they see an unmet need in their community. So this is certainly why it would be important to support older entrepreneurs. And it's yet another reason why it's important to support entrepreneurs of color and women entrepreneurs, because, especially during the pandemic, certain groups are seeing delivery of education or delivery of healthcare and can come up with really great new business ideas to respond to that.
So let's stay with that for a minute. You talk several times in the book about people getting into the room. And that made me think of the Hamilton song, The Room Where It Happened. And then I come across the story of Arlen Hamilton, a Black woman and the founder of Backstage Capital. Her company invests in companies with underrepresented founders. I'm going to play some sound for you. She talks to Business Insider about happened when she tried to start her first company.
There was not really anyone there for me to reach out to who could understand me as a person. And if they were there, I just couldn't find them. That's when I learned that if you were anything but a straight white man, you were honestly not even getting into the room.
So in our last couple of minutes, how do we change who gets into the room and how do we change the rooms themselves?
Yes. We bring a lot more investors to the table. We train them early. We say that investors don't have to have banking experience, for example, or we expand it to more people. We also have lots of hard conversations about why it's important, who runs our companies, and even individually, we can make shopping decisions based on who is running the company, who's owning the company. For example, there's a nonprofit called Buy From a Black Woman that has an online directory that can tell people which companies are out there that might sell something that you want to buy. So really thinking about where are my consumer dollars going, and then pushing for subsidized child care and family leave also has been shown to help underrepresented entrepreneurs. It's not one solution, but there's lots of things that can open up the entrepreneurial path. And truly, this benefits all of us. We will have these new jobs, new innovations. This is not just a benefit for the aspiring entrepreneur who's currently outside the room.
So briefly, and we've already talked about student loan debt relief, we have a divided Congress. It's a hard time to get legislation passed. But is there anything else that the U.S. government could do and we might get agreement on that would help advance women entrepreneurs and bring some of these 15 million potential jobs to life for us as we seek economic recovery? Just briefly.
Yes. Well, to stay with the student debt relief for a moment, there are a ton of proposals on the table. Some of them are quite narrow in that the people who have student debt relief are only people who are in the process of launching a company, and they have to show, you know, a company being formed, they have to hire X number of employees in order to qualify for the next level of student debt relief. So that's certainly, I think, something where you could find more agreement than the broader student debt relief for everyone. And I do think, to go back to the child care,
we're close to end of time. I think we have to end there. I'm sorry, this distance makes it a little hard to hear each other and get our rhythm. That's Susan Althoff. She wrote Launching While Female, Smashing the System That Holds Women Entrepreneurs Back. Thanks so much.